Ann Burroughs, announced that this is the 9/11 and other deep state crimes teleconference for the 25th of October, 1917. Ken Freeland and...
1917.
Did I really say that? Oh, my gosh. Talk about aging yourself. Okay, 2017, and Ken Freeland and Cheryl Curtis are facilitating... And Craig McKee is our trusty secretary, and we'll proceed from here with a review of the minutes from the last meeting. Does anybody have any objection to approving the minutes as sent out by Craig?
That link being replaced. Yeah.
Okay. I'm about to send Craig the I'm just going to copy. I just see it. Anniversary report, and I'm going to put in the right link and make that obvious, Craig.
Okay. Great.
All right.
And other amendments to the minutes other than Barb's new fresh link?
Ken, should we do the roll before we
It doesn't really matter what order we do this in. You're right. I should have done the roll first, but we'll go ahead and finish this off as long as we're here.
All right. Okay.
So, any other objections to approving the minutes? Hearing none, then we'll take the minutes for approved. And Craig, if you want to call the roll, go ahead.
Okay,
so
I'll read.
Approved with that one link change, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Change has been approved. Yeah, that's just okay.
Okay, so the names that I have are Ken Freeland, Craig McKee, Barry Zwicker, Cheryl Curtis, Dwayne Dietz, Greg Longo, David Rold, Pat O'Connell, John O'Malley, Kat McGuire, Barbara Honegger, Wayne Costi, Charles Ewing Smith, David Cole, Carl Golovin, James Hufford, Peter Michael Ketchum, Wayne Madsen, and Michael Cook. Did I miss anybody?
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Sounds like we're good.
We're getting background noise from somebody. Star 6, if that's you, please.
Sorry. Yeah, this is Mike Cook. I got kids in the room here. I'm Star 16.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Okay, so then if there's nobody that was overlooked Craig's roll call, we will proceed to look at tonight's draft agenda. Are there any amendments to the draft agenda? Hearing none, then we'll take the draft agenda for approval and proceed with our first item. Our guest of honor tonight is a return visit from none other than Wade Madsen, and here to introduce him and cover this segment of tonight's teleconference is my co-facilitator, Cheryl Curtis. Go ahead, Cheryl.
Okay, yeah. So I'm just going to introduce Wayne first. So Wayne Madsen is an internationally published author, journalist, and columnist. He's appeared on international news networks as a commentator on security and intelligence issues. He's worked in the past for the National Security Agency and the State Department, and he is a veteran officer of the U.S. Navy, and he's also the editor of WayneMadsenReport.com. So, Wayne, please, he's here to talk to us about what's happened to Professor Halsey and his students, the threats that have been made against them. So, Wayne, you're on.
Well, I guess...
I think you muted Wayne, too.
Okay. I guess most people should be familiar with the work of Professor Leroy Halsey and his graduate students at the University of Alaska on the World Trade Center Building 7 collapse analysis. And I would start this story back when his two grad students let me make sure I don't butcher their names too badly here. Let me find Feng Xiao and Zhili Quan. Back in December of last year, they received an email from an individual who first said, you know, congratulations on your work. Sort of buttering them up for the smack in the head. This email came from somebody who feigned some interest in the Building 7 collapse analysis. But when you look at the first email that they received, this person gets in. First he says, well, you know, the National Institute of Standards and Technology did a very good job, and so did the experts hired by Aegis Insurance, which was one of the companies, insurance companies involved in litigation after 9/11 regarding Building 7. And then this individual proceeds to tell them that, you know, that your research is partly funded by a advocacy group, and that is Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, that the individual says, well, you know, they're involved in conspiracy theories, and their theories are highly contentious. And then he says, I don't want to dissuade you from reaching any conclusion, but I hope you know how your work so far is being represented. So he's trying to work with them. Well, then this email was followed up this past August with another email to the two grad students, where they go into, you know, an attack mode against Professor Halsey, saying that he's devoted to conspiracy theories. And then the individual says, you know, your work is not undergoing a proper peer review process, and this could affect your future careers as engineers. The individual who sent these emails is a guy named, an attorney named Bill Ziegelbauer. Now, it was later discovered that William Ziegelbauer, same guy, is associated with a company, says he's involved in avionics. I don't know how you're an avionics expert and a lawyer at the same time, for Air Cargo Carriers of Janesville, Wisconsin. A little background, Janesville is also the hometown of our Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan. Not that that really has anything to do with the this story, but let's look at Air Cargo Carrier, ACC, which is based out of General Billy Mitchell International Airport in Milwaukee. So taking this person at his word that he is in some sort of a business position with ACC, Air Cargo Carrier. ACC is owned by a company, ACC Holding Incorporated. ACC also owns Telford Aviation, which is based in Milwaukee as well. It does business as the Telford Group. ACC is also known as ACC Integrated Services Incorporated, that offers short notice service throughout North America, Mexico, and the Caribbean. It was founded in 1986 at the height of the Iran-Contra affair and specializes in airlifting freight to various destinations in North America and the Caribbean. The president of AC is listed as James Germek of Milwaukee, and a subsidiary of the company is Milwaukee Avionics and Instruments, which is also based at Billy Mitchell Airport. I would add that the Milwaukee aspect is kind of interesting, because on the morning of 9/11, George H.W. Bush was in the air after having attended the advisory board meeting for the Carlyle Group at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in downtown Washington. He was supposed to be flying to St. Paul, Minnesota, but his flight was diverted to Milwaukee that day. And he and his wife, he said he and his wife were whisked off to a motel well outside the city limits of Milwaukee by the Secret Service. He never said what motel. That's just an interesting aside. This attorney, Ziegelbauer, uses addresses in Janesville, Wisconsin, but also Brooklyn and New York. Now, Telford, which is one of their affiliated companies, also operates a facility at the Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland under present DOD contract. Aberdeen, of course, is the main base, one of the main bases for the Army in testing new ordnance, including explosives. Telford also has an office in Dothan, Alabama, which is near the Army's Fort Rucker Aviation Training Base. But basically, they do a lot of training of helicopter pilots there. Interestingly enough, the owner and original founder of Telford Aviation was Telford Allen, who was killed on August 1st, 2010 in the crash of his Cessna float plane in the Moosehead Lake in Rockwood, Maine. The NTSB concluded that Allen had taken too much over-the-counter antihistamines and anti-allergy medication, which impaired his judgment. And they said that the pilot may have been having difficulty sleeping due to back pain or his impending surgery or possible chemotherapy. But the NTSB could not determine whether fatigue was a factor in the accident. A passenger survived that. Another passenger survived that crash, but the passenger said that the flight had been normal, and Mr. Allen had crashed in an area where he had landed the plane the same place every time. So he was very familiar with the area. 4 months after Allen's death in Maine, two air cargo carrier pilots, Kevin Kurantz of Sheboygan, Wisconsin, and Christopher Smith of Maryville, Tennessee, were arrested by the Dominican Republic police in Santo Domingo after 321 pounds of cocaine and 4 pounds of heroin were discovered hidden beneath the floorboards and behind the wall panels of their ACC aircraft. Also arrested were 19 members of the Dominican military. Now, Kurantz and Schmidt were temporarily based in Puerto Rico. They were released on bail of $12,000 each after the Dominican Republic's ambassador to Washington interceded with the Dominican Republic government in Santo Domingo. The two pilots agreed to return to Santo Domingo in the event of a trial. However, none was ever scheduled for him, and the Dominican prosecutor assigned to the case was very upset because the case was never brought to trial, and 12 of the Dominican military personnel initially arrested in connection with the drug bust were released without charges. ACC's been involved in a number of civil cases brought by ex-employees in 2015, a Hispanic American engineer working for ACC in El Paso filed a complaint that the Anglo-American employees of the company subjected him to harassment because of his Hispanic heritage, claiming that Mexicans are worthless. The El Paso court threw that suit out. Court records on ACC also indicate that in addition to operating in West Texas in the late 80s and 90s, they also operated out of Arkansas, which places the company right in the middle of the CIA covert operations involving the Mina airfield in support of the Nicaraguan Contras and the Colombian drug cartels, all of which is now featured in a movie I haven't seen yet about Barry Seal. So what we essentially have is a guy affiliated with a company that I believe is a CIA front threatened the two graduate engineers at the University of Alaska because of the work they and Professor Halsey were doing on the collapse of Building 7. And, I'm not really that shocked to find the CIA involved in this caper. It's just another example of the CIA and other intelligence agencies not coming clean on 9/11 and trying to basically curtail and shut down legitimate research into the 9/11 attack. And I think that's all I have, if anyone has any questions.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Wayne. And if everyone wants to, if you do *6, you can get into the queue for the lecture mode that we're going to start.
Okay, Wayne is unmuted, and star six if you want to ask a question or make a comment.
Okay. Any questions?
We have Barbara Honegger first. Barbara, go ahead. I guess I need to click on you. Okay. Okay, Barbara?
Yeah, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
I can hear you. How are you doing?
Oh, hi. Hi, Wayne. Great. Yeah. Thank you so much for this report and for your great work as usual. I just want you to know that our wonderful event in New York City, by the way, the final professional video is done, and I will send that to you. It's really a great, it was a great event and even a greater video. Just finished. I really have a comment and like you to comment on the comment, and that is, it's my understanding from our mutual friend Jane Clark that she did have a lot to do with the at least initial research on this story. Is that
yeah.
right? So a shout out to Jane.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was my comment.
Okay, Wayne, did you want to respond to that or next question?
Yeah, well, I just would add that Jane, it wasn't really hard to track down the connection of this guy, Ziegelbauer, to this particular company. He was representing himself to the grad students, not as somebody who was with air cargo carriers, but just, you know, an interested party that wanted to basically caution these two young grad students on how to avoid having problems and having a wonderful, you know, career in engineering, and never, of course, telling them who he actually was working with.
Right. Amazing. Thank you.
Okay, great. Wayne Costi, you're next.
Yeah,
Wayne,
this is Wayne Costi. I was curious if you have any knowledge about where these grad students have gone. I understand one of them finished his requirements and has moved on to a different university. Do you have any clue as to whether that was related to this implied threat? Over.
I'm not certain of that, but what I understand is, so they received the first email from this guy back in December of last year, and then, you know, all these many months go by, and it's August, and they hear from them again. It doesn't sound like they were really felt that this guy was in a position to pressure them, and maybe I don't know. I can't answer the question whether the one guy moved on to another university because of that, but I got the impression from what I you know, just, this was just talking to Jane Clark, that they didn't feel any pressure. They were very proud of the work they did at the University of Alaska.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay, sure. Dwayne Dietz, you're next.
This is Dwayne Dietz. My question was very similar to Wayne's, but I was wondering if Professor Holsey has made any comments on this.
I think he wasn't happy with it. I would add that here I will read the first email from December to the grad students. This guy Ziegelbauer informs them that the University of Alaska Fairbanks is a public university, which means all the emails, correspondence, and work done by you both and Professor Holsey is a matter of public record by law, meaning all such materials must be provided by the university to anyone who requests them. So this is obviously sort of a veiled threat that we're gonna go through all of your correspondence under the Alaska, you know, Freedom of Information Act. I haven't heard any public statements, Professor Holsey, about this, no.
Thank you.
Sure.
Okay, so we have two Mike Cooks. So the first Mike Cook, did you call in on two different numbers?
Yeah, two. Yeah.
Okay. All right, well, you're up, Mike.
Hey, once again, Wayne.
Okay, I'm hearing an echo.
Yeah,
real echo.
Sorry.
Still there.
I'll call back. I'll hang up and call.
Okay. Okay, so that was. Does anyone else have a question?
It's Craig. I had one. It's actually more of just of a comment because I was speaking to Ted Walter from Architects and Engineers earlier tonight, and he mentioned that because he just learned of the fact that we were going to be discussing this. He mentioned that the students, that none of the students were affected by these emails at all, and that they all were completely 100% with pushing forward, and they weren't intimidated. So that kind of confirms what Wayne was saying a couple of comments back.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I was led to believe also, that they didn't react to this guy's, you know, first is like, oh, I'm congratulations on your work. Now I want to trash it. they took it in the spirit that the emails were presented. Now I'm not certain they understood, or maybe they do now, but I'm not certain they knew who this guy was and who he was really representing. Because he did say, "Oh, I'm just an interested party here," but he was much more than that.
Right, right. Well, I know the AE people just wanted to, I guess, get the idea across that you know that there's no effect on the study and that no one should be concerned about the status of the study as a result of this.
Oh, I would add that, and this Jane, being an attorney, was able to do this. She tried to see if this guy was a member of any bars anywhere, state bars, federal bars, and nothing turned up. So he claims he's an attorney, graduated, I think, 2007 from the University of Chicago Law School, but he has not hung his shingle out there as an attorney, even though he claims to have an association with air cargo carriers, which, in my experience, it doesn't matter whether he went to law school or not. If he's working for the CIA, he's not going to be practicing law necessarily.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Okay, and then Mike Cook, I see, is back on with us. Mike, are you ready to go?
Yeah. Do I have an echo?
No, you don't.
Echo free.
Yay, echo free. Once again, thank you so much, Wayne, for all your awesome work. I've got these kids in the house, and I'm going to have to listen to the recording to know what's really going on.
Come on.
What? Yeah. So, but I wanted to bring up Las Vegas. And I know I don't want to derail this conversation, but this is a place we're going to have to go soon. It's hot still, kind of, and it's wide open for us. So thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Mike. Okay. Anybody else have
this
a question?
Is Kent. Yeah, this is Kent. I'm intrigued, Wayne, by your mention of the explosives testing connection there. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? I mean, do you know about what type of explosives or whether it could have in any kind of way?
You do not certainly. Aberdeen is really one of the largest proving grounds. Now obviously they're not testing them. What is it called? The mother of all bombs, the big huge bunker buster, because they would probably shatter windows in Baltimore and D.C. But they do a lot of testing of missile warheads and things like that at Aberdeen. So the fact that Telford has a facility there, and also at Dothan, which is an Army aviation training base. Now, of course, concentrating more on rotary wings, rotary wing aircraft, but still in all, why would Telford be a subsidiary or an affiliate of a company that claims it does short order cargo hops down to the Caribbean and Latin America?
I mean, it just reeks of the CIA.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, no question about that. I was just curious about whether or not there might have been some connection there with earlier studies on, say, you know, nanothermite or something along those lines. You know?
Well, this is an area that could be worth going pursuing because, you know, the National Institute of Standards and Technology is in Gaithersburg, Maryland, and the Aberdeen Proving Ground is not, it's also in Maryland. Well, obviously, you're not going to be doing explosive testings up in Gaithersburg because, you know, the neighbors would be rather upset about that. But if you wanted to do it, you wouldn't, you know, the closest place would be Aberdeen. So it'd be interesting to see if there's any sort of interagency agreement between the Commerce Department and the Department of Defense on using Aberdeen for that type of NIST testing.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't had a chance to look into that yet, but it wouldn't surprise me.
It just struck me that would be an obvious conflict there that might explain some litigation involved. Anyway, just for whatever.
Right.
Okay, thank you for that. Okay, sure. Go ahead, Cheryl.
Okay, so I think there's nobody else on the list. Anyone else have a question? Last chance. Okay, I guess not. Thank you very much, Wayne, for all your information and sharing that with us. And you're welcome to stay on the call. I know you sound like you're pretty busy, so we'd understand if you need to go.
Well, I just say, when it rains, it pours. I'm also, for those who may have followed the case of Phil Marshall, the guy who they claim killed himself, his two kids, and the family dog, there's been a recent development in that as well that I'm pursuing tonight. So stay tuned for more on that particular story.
And just, once you get a reminder for those of you who can spring for it, Wayne has a wonderful Wayne Madsen report that can be subscribed to, and you'll get the skinny right there every month. So be sure.
Yeah, and if you want to test it out, you can. There's a promo code that's it's GO8, capital G, capital O, number 8. That's a promo code, and I'll give you free access for, I don't know, 120 days or something like that, if you want to check it out.
Check that out. Okay. Right. Thank you. Thank you so much, Wayne.
Sure. Bye now.
Bye, Wayne.
Uh-oh. What is that?
Somebody got some.
Wow, we got background music. How about that?
can you hear us all now? Can you hear us?
Yes.
We could. Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody,
could somebody repeat the access code?
To this
551571.
No. What Wayne Madsen just said for his site.
Oh.
Oh, the promo code is GO8.
G letter O 8.
Right.
Go 8. Okay.
Go 8.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. So that brings us to our second presentation for this evening, and that will be with our regular participant, but famed cinematographer now, Chuck Smith. Chuck, of course, has many Hollywood offerings to his credit as a sound producer and so forth, but from our perspective, his claim to fame is having helped mastermind Expert Speak Out and his own 9/11 what was it called? I forgot the name of that.
Demolition.
Demolition of Truth. Demolition of Truth, right, which was featured on Colorado Public TV as part of their fundraiser. So that got a lot of play and hopefully brought some converts to our movement. So tonight, we're going to be discussing with Chuck his film, his latest release, called 9/11 Rogue Agenda, which deals very deftly, in my view, with a very tricky subject, which is, of course, the role of the neocons and the Zionists in U.S. foreign policy in general, and in 9/11 in particular. So, would you like to give us some starting comments, Chuck, before we get started with the discussion?
Oh, well, you know, I mean, the film kind of...
Maybe reminding us how the film came about and, you know, what the motivation was and how well it was received and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, I was... I had finished up my role on 9/11 explosive evidence, and I was frustrated because the couple of years I spent on that, the world kept rolling around, and Israel was attacking Palestine more and more, and I noticed that our character was changing, that we were taking on behaviors that we were taking for granted this is the right way to respond, and I'm going, wait a minute, this is the opposite of everything we've ever fought for. And I started thinking about that, and so I thought, well, I'll go back. I found an archive on archive.org of all the television broadcasts of the first few days, 9/11 and the first couple of days afterwards. And so I decided to take a look, and I realized that the BBC had a whole different thing going on than what we had here. And so I downloaded all these videos and looked at them and chopped out bits and pieces here and there and whatever, and realized that Israel made a full pitch effort on the BBC on the day of 9/11 for the U.S. to not treat 9/11 as a crime, but as a war where we need to start attacking countries. And I didn't find that in American television on 9/11. I'm pretty sure it showed up shortly after, but I found it with some American people talking on television. They were espousing those views already, but nobody really sat down and pitched it like Ehud Barak did on the BBC, I think four or five times during that one day. He was there from morning to night. And I started looking at those things, and I realized, oh, my God, these people are telling the United States what to do. And then here, of course, I'm looking at it many years later, and, of course, that's exactly what we did. And everybody just fell in line with these points of view, which were murderous and treasonous and against the law and everything. So, anyway, I was frustrated not having anything to do, so I decided to just take those videos and try and make something out of them. And I found that the big issue was the changing character of this country, of mm-hmm. how things that are important, like the Geneva Convention, with its, you know, laws or judgments about how to treat civilians, are just completely ignored. And Ehud Barak gives prime examples of that in his day at the BBC. So anyway, I got all stoked to do it, and I started doing it, and I realized that it was me venting, and I wasn't sophisticated enough at the time to take a higher approach. This was me still teaching myself how to make movies. And so I just decided to make it a personal thing. And so I have personal asides all the way through it. It's clearly the voice of the man introduced at the beginning, who's mad as hell and not going to take it anymore. And I was kind of nervous how people would respond to that, because everybody wants, you know, a high-minded approach to these things. And I tried to do that with my other two documentaries, but this one is really more just me screaming. And I haven't been able to cut it yet. I want to edit it down. I'm reworking it to some degree, and I want to edit it down and everything. And you folks have seen the long version, and those of you that took the time to look at it. And, you know, it's how I feel about things, and I've gotten a really good response from anybody that's looked at it. I'm not getting any on YouTube. It's on YouTube. It's not getting a lot of hits, but it's positive, and very positive. So, and some people have said that it was really like required viewing and all that. So I'm happy I made it. I am re-editing it because I'd like to get it whittled down to something that's manageable, because Ken up at the 9/11 Truth Festival said that he'd like to show it next year if I could get it down to 2 hours.
Wow. That's inviting.
So, anyway, I'm anxious to hear what anybody watched it, what they have to say, because to me it's a stab in the dark, you know, making it
okay.
So personal and all that.
Okay, I think we'll go into Q&A mode here so that we can take turns. A number of people did offer to view the film so that we would have informed criticism available for Chuck. So let's start. Star 6, if you want to make a comment or ask Chuck a question, and he's welcoming constructive criticism because he's in the process of reworking that film so that it can be shown in other quarters. And who would like to make a first comment? Okay, we'll start with Barb. Go ahead, Barb.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Oh, good. I haven't been able to watch it yet. I will. Are you open to, you know, those of us who take the time to carefully look at it to get your feedback?
Oh, my God, I'd love it. I'd love nothing more, because who else could I share this with?
Okay.
You know, I mean...
And the only other thing I wanted to thank you, I believe you did the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 inquiry film in the nick of time.
Yeah.
For our 9/11 event in New York City, right?
Yeah, it was down to the wire.
Down to the wire. Thank you so much. I mean, everything came together miraculously just before it went on. And I just want to remind you especially, I don't know if you know, you might not, Chuck, have gotten, are you on the 9/11 leaders call list? Would you have received the link to the final video of that event that includes your film?
No.
Okay. Just please give me your email address and I'll send it to you now. What's your email address?
Oh, it's chucksmith1@mac.com, mac.com.
chucksmith1.
Yes.
Okay, thanks a lot. That's it.
Okay.
Thank you.
While waiting for others to line up with some comments, I just like to say, you know, that my personal impression was that, first of all, this is a very tricky subject because of the nature of criticism of Israel that usually brings brickbats with it for folks that indulge. And so I think Chuck deserves a lot of credit for tackling it as adroitly as he did. But also, this film, it seems to me, granted that it could be edited to some greater degree, is certainly the best effort yet to document exactly what he set out to document, which is the clear preparedness, as it were, seeming preparedness of Israeli spokesmen to marshal the world toward war on the basis of 9/11 on the very day and within hours of 9/11. So that in itself is a priceless feat, and I want to thank Chuck for having taken the time to put this together, because I don't know anybody else that's focused on this before or since, and with such alacrity.
Thank you.
Okay, so Star 6, anybody that would like to make a comment or ask a question? I know a lot of us committed last week to watch it and provide feedback, so please...
Well, it's long.
Chuck is waiting to hear.
So this is Cheryl. I'd like to make a comment. I watched it in little. I skipped around because I didn't have time to do the full 3 hours. But what I did see, I really liked. I thought it was really good. And I noticed that there was when you're looking for who's behind it all, the Saudis didn't appear in that, and I thought that was interesting since there's a lot of people trying to blame 9/11 on the Saudis. So.
When I made that, the Saudis weren't, you know, they, of course, all the hijackers were supposedly Saudis, which, you know, has been disproved. But The Saudis weren't even in the news at all about it. Nobody was talking about it when I made it. And even now, I think the Saudis are puppets in this thing also.
Right.
Or not puppets. They might have been up to something, but they were useful idiots.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
Okay, thanks, Cheryl. Michael Cook, you're next.
Hey,
Michael?
Chuck, Mike Cook.
Hi, Mike.
Hey, yeah, awesome work. I'm only like 45 minutes into it. I love all the quotes. You're doing great stuff there. I would suggest that if there's a quote up, that there not be like other audio words going on, because that confuses the heck out of me. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I don't know if I do that. I didn't mean. The only other audio words are me reading it.
Yeah, well, that's okay. If you're reading it, that's okay. If there's music or something, but sometimes there's people talking besides.
Oh, I didn't know. Oh, okay. I'll take another look at that. I try not to do that, but I didn't know anything when I made this thing. So. I learned an awful lot on the demolition of truth, because I had various astute people, you know, commenting on it and keeping me from derailing.
Well, no, you're doing great. You're doing great, and it's awesome. I look forward to seeing the final cut. And the Saudi thing needs to be addressed for what it is. You know that it's a redirection. Yeah, they were involved. Allegedly, these alleged hijackers were Saudis, and money came through there apparently, and whatever. But that's not the deeper issue. So you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my issue was to pinpoint the obvious use of the media to manipulate an entire country and its leaders.
Yeah,
and
the media and the government are hand in glove in this.
And then to back it up with evidence that these people have a history of this kind of thing, that this is something that's been ongoing. I didn't really get too far into it. I didn't get into that too deep, but it's just, damn it, they're the obvious people to at least investigate.
It's nothing new, you know, to those of us paying attention and trying to wake people up. I love you.
Thanks, Ann.
All right. And Bill Wilt is next. Bill.
Hi. I liked it a lot. One comment that I might make as you go over the re-edit. I think your the text superimpositions.
Yes.
You took them as a whole file of them. That makes it's a great structure you've got in place already. It could take a little tweaking fore and aft with some of the, you know, the timing of when the text comes in or when the scroll comes in or something, but just look at, you know, pull that text out and look at it as an outline, because it really works pretty well. I mean, I noticed that it occurred to me that something was off when it was a little off, like I completely sort of fell in with the cadence of it and the structure of it and your voiceover and so on. The tool for tweaking that perhaps is using the text outline, just for what it's worth.
Well, I'm not quite sure what you mean by text outline.
Well, you've got superimposed text in places, right?
Yes.
And some of it you're doing a voiceover reading it, and I'm assuming, since I played a little bit with iMovie and stuff, that there's a text file that you got somewhere. Well, maybe not, but you could have put a text file in, or you created one, and then you cut and paste the headlines. So use that text file or that collection of text as an outline.
Meaning, by outline, I think he means that you could break it up into segments that people could then access by segment, according to that.
Well, that's even better. Yeah, that's even better. I was thinking just in the, you know, the fore part, but yeah.
Well, that'd make it even longer.
Well, I don't think so, because there's stuff that could be edited out because of.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, I was joking because of, say, if something was two paragraphs long and I broke it down into into two cards, that would probably run longer than if I just let the whole thing run. That's all I was joking about.
Whatever, but I liked it a lot. I I'm at the stage with so many of us are, I suppose, where you do want to scream. It's just like we've been at this for a long time, and how do we wake people up? Start from grabbing him by the shoulders and shaking him real hard. That's all I got.
So you didn't think I was too obnoxious by making my comments about Zionist leaders?
No, absolutely not. Listen, I'm all prepared to go back to Nuremberg and or even back to 1850, the six myth of the 6 million trademark is what I call it.
Right.
You know, this has been going on for at least a century.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks so much, Bill. Okay, and we've got Wayne Costi with a comment or a question. Go ahead, Wayne.
Yeah. Hi, Chuck.
I
haven't had a chance to look at it. I've been busy on some other things that we'll talk about later. But my question to you is, how do you envision this being used for action? Because there's a couple of things that it could be used for. One is just simply background information. One is education about how the media is used and manipulated. How do you envision this being used as a basis for action, and what do you think people would do with it use it in kind of the current world? Those are my questions.
When you frame it like that, I feel bad about making it because because it is really capable of creating anger, and it was me being angry, and I just decided that that's what it would be. But when you phrase it like that, I feel like, I think it's something that's just out in front. You know, it's out there clearing the brush away for the real troopers to come in with the more articulate explanations.
Well, one answer might be that people could, make a contribution to the lawyers committee to see about getting a real investigation, right?
Oh, well, I mean, but the lawyers committee doesn't support my documentary.
No. But that's not the point. The point is, what can people do with the emotions that are aroused by the film? And one answer might be that they could support an organization like Lawyers Committee that is seeking adjudication, which might lead to a real investigation.
Yeah, you're helping me. I think its purpose is to get people off their butt.
Yeah, and it shouldn't.
It's a blunt instrument.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks. That's the question I wanted to pose. And when I get to review it, I may have some comments along with some of those lines. Thanks.
Oh, I'd love it.
Okay, and I think that was the last comment, Wayne. So if you'd like to give people a way to contact you if they see it later and would like to offer you some constructive feedback?
Oh, well, sure. ChuckSmith1, the number one, at mac.com. I'm totally open to criticism and comments of any kind because it's a group effort.
ChuckSmith1, the number one, at mac.com, right? M is in Mary, ac.com, right?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks again for doing that wonderful work and for giving us something to really sink our teeth into. And thank you all who did follow through and watch it and provide the feedback that is going to help Wayne move forward.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks again, Wayne. All right. And our last presentation tonight will be from Wayne Costi, who will be talking about his response to some questions raised by Craig regarding the Pentagon. And I think we all recall some of the other presentations Wayne's made on this subject. So, Wayne, it's your floor. Go for it.
First of all, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So this is in response to, largely in response to some questions raised a couple of months ago when I gave a presentation on the tree at column 16 and what that meant, and I went over the fact that there had been this large tree. The question was, how can the plane have actually impacted this, not hit the ground, avoided wire spools, and things like that. So I've got a very long presentation that I have 15 minutes to go through, so I'm going to do my best. Many of the slides that are here are pairs of them. There'll be a slide, and then there'll be one that has something highlighted. So I'm going to have to go through this pretty quickly. You can download this, if you haven't already, from the website www.hopeoutloud.org/Pentagon. It's the top one. It's called Analysis of Pentagon Plane Approach and Impact. That's hopeoutloud.org/Pentagon. So I'm just going to jump into the presentation. I'm going to talk about some orientation. Well, where's the plane? How is it approaching? I'm going to touch on the G-force calculation because that is something that some people say prevents, that makes it impossible for the plane to have approached. I'm going to then talk about the wire spools and what the west side of the Pentagon looked like at the time, and then project the plane damage onto the facade. You're going to see a couple of things you've never seen before, and that is the analysis of the spools, because no one's ever done this before. And the other thing is we're going to see the bastion columns on the second floor. You may have seen them, but you may not have noticed what you were looking at. So jumping to slide five, it's an overview of the plane path with the area swept by the wings.
Wayne, just a second. I went to the website that you said, and there's a list of things there, and none of them that I can see. October 2017, the top one. Okay, thank you. Okay.
Analysis of the plane Pentagon approach, right.
Yeah, so. Got it. Okay.
Okay, and the link, again, didn't work in the agenda. So so on slide five, it's an overview of the plane path with the area swept by the wings. Shows kind of the orientation. The key things are the Sheridan and the VDOT tower. If you go to slide six, there's a topography. It shows you what the profile looked like. The plane is going to have to be descending past the Sheridan, the tower, down to the Pentagon. Slide seven shows the shows an exaggerated scale version of this. Showing that the plane is going past the Sheridan to the left of the VDOT tower and descending all the way into the Pentagon, hitting the lamppost for lamppost number one. If you put everything into a correct scale, vertical and horizontal, you end up with a very flat landscape, and that is what you can see on slide eight. The next section talks about the G-forces, and I just want to touch on this really briefly. Pilots for 9/11 Truth has said it is impossible for a plane to approach and swing down because the G-forces would be 10.14 G-forces. And in order to come up with their calculation, they had a 2,085-foot radius for a plane pulling out of a dive. Slide 11 shows this drawn to scale on top of the image we saw earlier. And in order for that arc to be valid, the plane has to be traveling in the arc, and it has to get into the arc. It can't just be passing by it. It has to actually enter the arc in order for the equation to work. And there's no way a plane can transition passing anywhere near the Sheridan, the VDOT tower, and transition into a 2,000-foot radius arc because the G-forces would be too high to get it into the arc, never mind getting it out of the arc when it came down below. If you actually take a look at the flight path, the flight path is consistent with a 16,000-foot radius, which if you calculate it out using their formulas, it's 1.16 Gs. So all within the structural limits of a plane. So now we're going to talk about some of the west wall of the Pentagon before 9/11. Jump into slide 14. We see the west wall. We see the tree highlighted. We see the retaining wall pointed out where it's going to be impacted, and we see the wire spools. Now I'm going to be zooming in on some of these images related to the side here. Going on to slide 15, we're going to take a look at the retaining wall gouge. You can see it's a big chunk taken out of this little retaining wall. To show you where that is in relationship to the plane approaching, if you go to slide 16, you can see the wing outlines. You can see where the engine outlines are in the orange lines. The right engine is going to hit the generator trailer. The left engine is going to be right in position to hit the retaining wall. So everything all kind of lines up. It's got some of the dimensions. There's 450 feet there. If you go to slide 17, I highlight where the impact of the retaining wall is, where column 14 is, and slide 18 adds the fact that the generator trailer is out about 80 feet. So it's not right on the wall, but it's still 80 feet. It'll take some time and some ability for the plane to get jostled around. Slide 19 shows the plane superimposed on the generator trailer on where the engine's going to hit the generator trailer. The left engine's going to hit the retaining wall. And you can see how everything lines up with the little image on the top left-hand side. So you can see the dimensions all kind of work out. You can also notice, if you look through the plane, just in front of the engines, you can see the wire spools, and you can see the plane is kind of cutting. In this case, I didn't realize what it would look like, but it's going right between a lot of the spools that you're seeing there. So we're going to jump into the wire spool section. Slide 21, the presence of the wire spools have been cited as evidence against the large plane impact. The post-impact photos show them in the path of the plane. However, their initial location was never known. I've been able to identify where they were, and I want to share that with you. What we're going to see is that there are 7 spools, and we can only find 5 of them in the post-impact photos. I've labeled them. I think the ones I call 5 and 6 are probably the right ones. The ones I label 3, 4, and 7 are my best guess as to which one they actually are. Moving on to slide 22, we have the west wall, and I've highlighted where the generator trailer, the spools are. I'm going to zoom into those on slide 23. You can actually count them there if you want. If you go to slide 24, what I've done is I've highlighted where the spools are. 1, 2, and 3 are to the right. 4, 5, 6, and 7 are to the left. And you can see where they're located. Now, if you go to a satellite photo, it was taken September 7th. I was shocked actually to see this when I zoomed in, that you can actually see the wire spools, and they're all in the locations that we've seen in the photographs. We see 1, 2, and 3 on the right-hand side, and a cluster of 4, 5, 6, and 7 on the left, suggesting that they were there the Friday before. Now, the next sets of slides are just pairs of slides showing the spools from different perspectives. From a front-on perspective, slide 26 shows the spools. You can look really hard and find them, or you can go to slide 27, and where I've highlighted the ones in about the right orientations for them. So we see 5 of them, and that's all I can seem to find. And I've identified 2 of them. I call them 1 and 2 that I don't know where they are. I haven't seen any damage or any pieces of them or anything like that that are clearly identified in the photos. Slide 28 shows the three of the spools knocked toward the wall, in addition to the 2 that stay about where they were. Slide 29 shows them highlighted. Slide 30 is another picture. I can only see 4 of the spools. The 5th one's obscured by smoke. Slide 31 shows where they are located in that picture. I'll point out that one of the things that baffled me for a while is there was a spool that I couldn't figure the orientation out, but spool number 4 was standing up after the plane impact, but before the wall collapsed, and then after it collapsed, because it was close enough, it got knocked over. The next set of slides is a series of about a dozen of them. I'm going to go through really pretty quickly because they're just like snap action shots. They're one time step. And so what we see on slide 33 is the plane is approaching the impact area before hitting the generator trailer. Slide 34 shows it hitting the generator trailer, and I begin a yaw rotation. I rotate the angle 1 degree for each of the time steps until the right wing hits the Pentagon, and then I step it up to 2 degrees. And that's what the number is that you'll see changing in the middle of the picture. Slide 35 shows it before it hits the retaining wall. Slide 36 shows that where it would be if it hit the retaining wall. I've looked to the area that I've circled in all the photos I can find. I haven't seen anything that looks like the wingtip hitting, but the engine, of course, certainly did hit the retaining wall. Slide 37 shows the plane continuing towards the facade, probably hitting and accelerating the spools, number 4 and 7, and knocking them towards the building, and maybe others. Again, don't know what actually happened there. Slide 38 is just continuing another time step. Slide 39, the nose hits at column 14. Slide 40, the plane continues impacting the facade. Slide 41, the right engine impacts the window to the left of column 17, and I'll show you where that comes from. Slide 42, the right wing spar bashes in the second floor columns 18 and 19. That's slide 42. Slide 43, the left engine impacts about column 12. The left wing impacts column 9A in slide 44, that time step. Slide 45, the bulk of the plane's on the inside. And the last one is slide 46, where the tail is impacting near column 12. So we're going to take a look at the damage at some of these key locations that we can use to place where the plane is. So we go to slide 48. The damage to columns 18 and 19 on the second floor. This is new. As far as I know, no one's ever talked about this before. I was shocked when I actually saw them. And figured out and saw what I actually and recognized what I actually saw. The evidence, it's evidence of a large momentum-based impact event, and it's consistent with the large plane. We'll see how it fits into the superimposition of the plane. And it can't be explained by other hypotheses as I can envision it. Interior explosives, exterior explosives, or a cruise missile type event, or anything else. Slide 49 shows the columns kind of, you can kind of be zoomed in. You can see the base of the column has been knocked in. You can go to pictures of the day, and you can see column 19 clearly is like out of kilter in the Jason Ingersoll photos at all. Column 18 is a little bit obscured, but you can see here in slide 49 that there's a real disconnect between the upper column and the lower one. Slide 50 is just another picture of column 19. Slide 51 is yet another picture of column 19 bashed inward. Going down to the north end of the opening, column 9AA is bowed inward at the north end from the wing impact. We've talked about that before. Taking a look at the other damage above the second floor, because the plane is going to have impacted below the second floor slab, and so there's some significant damage at column 12. Slide 53 is the best picture we have of the what's going on at the north end. Slide 54 shows what happened at columns 12 and between columns 12 and 13. And as near as I can tell, this is probably a strong indication of the tail section hitting there and being dragged into the by the rest of the structure into the building and pulling down the beam in the front. That's why the beam comes from the left but ends at column 11, and you don't see it after that. Because the mass of the plane is, the wing is underneath this, so something above it hit. So now let's project the plane onto the facade. I've got some notes on slide 56 about how I did this, some of the dimensions. I'm glad to talk about it later. the plane's impacting at a 4 degrees to the horizontal. Slide 57 is a Jason Ingersoll photo that shows the plane, or it shows the facade without a plane projected on it, and slide 58 projects the plane onto it. This has the engines hitting just below or just above the ground level onto the facade, you can't, because the plane is actually traveling, there's stuff in the foreground that looks like it's in the way, but the plane's actually traveling from right to left. So now looking at the three critical points, slide 59 shows the right wing bashing into the column 19 and 18. Slide 60 shows the wing impacting and where it would have bowed in column 9AA. Slide 61 shows the tree, shattered tree stump of the plane at about the right height there. And you can see that the engine would be at about column 17.
Oh, Wayne, you're at 15 minutes, just to let you know, okay? So we have to cut this pretty quick.
Oh, yep. So slides 62, 63, and 64 are just the engine trace from the generator trailer to the impact wall. It appears that because the engine is not just hitting sideways into the generator trailer, but in fact pushing down on it because it's descending, that the left engine has to rotate down a little bit, probably gets whacked down onto the ground, bounces up, that could explain some of the witnesses having said that the plane bounced, because it probably did because of the engine. Slide, the answer to the questions are basically that the mass of the plane was descending slightly across the lawn, the right engine impacted the generator trailer. The right engine can't descend at the same rate and causes rotation around the center of mass. The left engine impacted the ground at the retaining wall. Downward movement was arrested and reversed, and the left wing tip apparently didn't hit the ground. The right engine impacted the slide 68. The right engine impacted the facade to the left of column 17 near the lower half of the window, traveling horizontal. No impact into the floor slab, as some have said we should have seen. The left engine impacted into column 12. The damage at the second floor is suggestive of the tail impact. The wire spools on slide 69 rolled from their storage area between the generator trailer and the retaining wall, rolled in the wake of the plane or moved because they were impacted. The plane, they came to the final post-impact location after the plane had already passed by. And there's no photographic record of two of the seven spools, suggesting their damage, their destruction upon impact or rolling into the Pentagon. And the last thing is aligning the plate, the plane with key damage points, the second floor, the column 19, the first floor, column 9AA, and the severed tree stump places the plane in the facade. And I hope that answers Craig's questions, and I'll take any questions you want. I'll give you the best answers I can that I have available. Over.
Okay. Well, I think since this was a response to a question from Craig, we had to give Craig the first opportunity to see whether or not he agrees that it was an answer to his questions. So we'll give him the first shot, and then we'll go into Q&A mode, and folks that have additional questions or comments can go ahead. Go ahead, Craig, if you have anything to say.
Okay, yes, I do. Thank you. My focus for this question is not on the wire spools, but on the flight path that you indicate at the beginning of your presentation. It seems to me that that your graphic showing the flight path is both wrong and misleading about what could have happened to the plane. It doesn't match the official path, and it doesn't match the path that you have shown us in past presentations. It also doesn't line up with the damage, including the C-ring hole. You've shown only one light pole, which I think hides the inaccuracy of the graphic. Had you shown all five, I think that would have been much more difficult. And also, I don't even think you have light pole number one really in the correct position. It's close, but it's not exactly correct. And I'm not even sure that based on your graphic, whether the right wing of the plane even could have made contact with light pole number three. It looks like it possibly might have missed it entirely. Now, you appear to have done this, from all I can see, is you appear to have done this to avoid the problem of the VDOT antenna, because the official flight path requires that the plane go either to either side or above the antenna. And since the official flight path, the antenna is in the direct path of the plane, it would have to go over. And the flight data recorder, in fact, records an altitude of 699 feet above sea level at this point. And and I think because you have this flight path incorrect, you have the plane flying to the north of the VDOT antenna and over the Navy Annex, which I have literally never seen anybody claim this before, certainly not anybody who's pushing the official path. And I think because you have the plane lower than the top of the antenna, then that invalidates your claims about the G-forces, because you are claiming to invalidate pilots for 9/11 Truth's position because of the fact that you have the plane below the top of the antenna, and clearly they have it going over the antenna. In fact, their G-forces they calculate, 10.14 Gs, is the most conservative they could calculate while still having the plane go over the tower. It doesn't have, they don't have it at the altitude indicated on the flight data recorder. They just have it the minimum that it could be. So I would love to hear you explain how you came up with a completely new flight path and how you can justify the plane being to the north of the tower and below the top of the tower.
Well, you've listed about 30 different things, so I'll take my best shot at some of them. The flight path, I believe, is in accordance with witnesses. It doesn't comport with the flight data recorder, which I don't ever use because I don't. I think there are so many people out here that would say it's not usable and give reasons why it looks bogus. I have no use for the flight data recorder. The witnesses and even the CIT witnesses who you speak so highly of. Mentioned that the plane is flying just above the Navy Annex, very close, just missing it, just coming over it. Nothing about it being up nearly 600 or 800 feet. There's other witnesses as I've identified. I've got three of the names on slide seven: Deb Onluff, Steve Sorey, Don Vignola. They're just the three that I happen to know that say that they saw the plane pass below the roof line of the Sheridan. So, there are many other witnesses that I have not attempted to record where they were. So the flight path seems to be quite consistent with what witnesses have said. And again, it's not with a flight data recorder, which I don't think is particularly useful. Let's talk about the G-force issue because it is pretty critical. If you go to my slide 11, which places the 2,085-foot radius in perspective, it says if you were going to be in this radius, and you have to be in the radius for the calculation to be right, it's got to be at some point in that curve, you have to be in that radius. And there's no way to get from anything close. I know what the Pilots for 9/11 Truth video says, but you can't get into that arc, that 2,085-foot arc, from anything approaching the Sheridan, Navy Annex, VDOT Tower, whatever, without doing a real sharp dive to get into the arc and then to follow the arc and undo that dive you just did, because you can't get into the arc without G-forces that would be equal to or exceed the 10 Gs that the plane couldn't handle, they say. So there's no way to get into that arc unless you started really high. The gross error, and if you go to the appendix, I have references to the Pilots for 9/11 Truth analysis. I put everything in perspective. I show it and let them explain it in their own words, as well as just showing them just what it is they've actually said. The flight path, I think you criticized that, but I think the flight path is consistent. I wasn't attempting to make the flight path line up with light poles 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I was just trying to get the altitude. I could go on, I suppose, but I think you have a more focused questions, and then we can move on to some others. But go ahead, next round.
Well, all I want to nail down is, the flight path is, to me, the center. I think it's the most important thing in your presentation, because you have indicated a flight path that suggests that the plane could have flown to the left or the north of the tower and below the top of the tower. And this is critical because it cannot do that and remain on the official path. And the official path is what is required if you're going to claim that the plane hit all the light poles and made all the damage right through to the C-ring hole. So you've got a flight path that doesn't line up with the damage.
Well, I do have a flight path that lines up with the damage on the generator trailers, the schools, destroying the trailers in front, impacting it, and traveling at the correct angle to travel through the first floor all the way to the C-ring, as I talked about in one of my last presentations. I think it was August. So the angles all line up, and if you're suggesting that what I need to do is go through and take a look, a much closer look at the flight path, maybe I can I can do that a little bit more precisely. But I didn't think that was the main issue. The main issue was there are many witnesses that say the plane was not way above the tower, but below it, below the top of it, and near the Navy Annex, and that the angle, that there's no way for that for that plane to approach the arc that pilots from 9/11 Truth has been saying.
Okay, Wayne, Craig is saying that the only way to account for the damage of the building is the official flight path, and yours diverges from it. You're saying that yours explains it as well as the official story. You're not saying it is the same or not the same as the official story, though, right?
I believe it is the same as the official story.
Okay, well, he's saying it's not, so maybe that's a point of departure for a future debate, or at least presentation or something, or response of some sort, okay? Because that seems to be important.
I got that on my list, thanks.
Okay, thank you. And does anybody else have a comment or question before we move on to announcements? A comment or question regarding Wayne's presentation? All right, well, hearing none, thank you, Wayne, for another detailed presentation. And we will move on to announcements for tonight. Does anybody have anything to share, an announcement? Oh, I'm sorry, I think a lot of people are muted. Let me, I guess we're still in Q&A.
There are a few people who would like to comment.
There are. Well, I didn't see anybody. Oh, yes, there are. Okay, I'm sorry. Star 6, if you want to comment. David Roldy, you're first.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, David. Go ahead. Which comment or your question, please?
Okay, my question is does your work, like, account for what kind of airplane it is? Are you saying that it was the allegedly hijacked passenger jet that hit the Pentagon, or could it have been some other plane that was brought in to replace that?
Wayne, are you muted? Wayne Costi. Did we lose Wayne?
I think Wayne is muted. I unmute. Okay.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much. That was a great question. The only thing that I have been looking at is what could have caused the damage, and the dimensions that I've been using are based on a 757-200. So everything seems to be consistent with that. I have no idea from the materials that I can see, the physical damage, what if there were people on the plane. Was it the thing called Flight 77? I have no idea. I have only been trying to answer the question to my satisfaction, and hopefully get yours, what actually happened at the Pentagon, and it is perfectly consistent with a large plane impact.
Okay, that's fair.
If it was like a drone plane, could it have withstood the greater G-forces?
Well, there's no need for greater G-forces. A drone plane, such as a remotely controlled 757, which is probably the most likely scenario. Matter of fact, I can't imagine. It certainly isn't Hani Hanjour doing this his first try. So it's most likely a remotely controlled 757, either the thing known as Flight 77, although there's a lot of questions about whether there even was one. But it's a plane that looks like it, and the fact that they won't release any serial numbers for anything, the wrong type of flight data recorder or cockpit voice recorders, suggests that it was a plane possibly taken out of storage someplace that was doctored up for this use. But that's my speculation, but it's consistent with the 757 profile. Over.
Okay, that's fair enough. Thank you, William. We have two other commenters, so let's keep them brief, please, folks, because we need to close out here. Dwayne, you're next. Dwayne Dietz?
Yeah, this is Dwayne Dietz. I felt like I ought to stand up and applaud when I heard this, but of course, that's kind of foolish in my own room. But I will say that the spools have caused me the most frustration, because I could never figure out how I could figure out where the spools were before the plane passed, assuming a plane passed. So I think Wayne has done an excellent job at researching that, and it's very credible what he's come up with. The second point is Wayne mentioned that the wing striking, the right wing striking between columns 18 and 19 is the first, this is the first time anyone's come up with this. That is something that I included in my talk at the Pentagon at the Sheraton Hotel, I think it was in 2013. And when I've been asked ever since then, because there have been all kinds of people that have been critical of my talk, and they ask me, what is the strongest evidence that what I was saying was correct? I always answered that obvious evidence of wing or something striking that particular thing, 18 and 19 on the second floor. So that was so out in the open. It was something that if a wing didn't hit it, what did? And I couldn't imagine what else had struck that. So I'll just leave it at that.
Oh, thanks, Dwayne. I was there to see your presentation. I must say that I was not inclined. I was actually disinclined to a large plane impact at that time. And it wasn't until I had to actually look at the pictures and explain them that I had to start losing sleep over that. And now I've come, I guess, to this place where I'm one of those evidence advocates for large plane impact. But thanks. That's all. Over. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. And last, Barbara. Keep it brief, please. Barbara, go ahead.
Oh, hi. It's Barbara. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Yep, everybody can hear me? Okay, great. Oh, I've taken a completely different position, and I'm going to prove it to you. So what I just sent everybody, yet again, is the photograph that proves that what Wayne has tried to put off on us cannot be true. This is the critical photograph, the black and white photograph, of the outside of the west face of the Pentagon. And there is a red circle that is the approximate diameter of the fuselage of a 757-200, which Wayne has just acknowledged he was using as the basis for his analysis. What everyone needs to know, when you pull up this photograph, whether you can pull it up now or after this call, that column in literally the middle of the red circle is where the official story, Wayne is pushing, is where the official story says the nose and fuselage of a 757 going over 530 miles an hour smashed into that wall. And column 14 is not only the bullseye point, but that column is still in place before the wall fell, after whatever caused the destruction in the Pentagon. And the floor slab to the right or the south of that still in place column 14. We are literally talking about the crosshairs of the bullseye of the official story that a huge 757 going at over 500 miles an hour. It is impossible for the official story to be true and that column being there and the floor slab still being in place to the right or the left of that still in place second floor vertical column 14. Now, Wayne said in his presentation, Wayne Costing, quote, I wrote it down as he said it, the plane impacted below the second floor slab and, quote, the plane traveled through the first floor. This is provably false. The fuselage of a 757-200 itself is 12 and a half feet in diameter, and the engines that are under the wings are another 4 to 4.5 feet below the bottom of that 12 and a half foot lower portion of the fuselage, for a total of 17 feet. The first floor is not 17 feet. It's about 13 to 14 feet maximum. That is why the Pentagon Building Performance Report, the official ASD report, says that it was column 14 at literally the second floor vertical column and a little bit into the first floor, this is the official claim now, and second floor slab. In his presentation, Wayne Costing wants us to believe that you can have a plane hit at literally the bullseye where column 14 and the second floor floor slab to the right or the south of that vertical second floor column 14, the bullseye of the plane is still in place after the alleged impact. This is physically impossible, people. And not only that, the official story says that the alleged plane, the 757-200, came in at an oblique or diagonal angle, something like 42 degrees. You can correct me if it's a little bit off, but at an oblique angle. And if it did hit where the official story and Wayne want you to believe, not only would that column not be there, nor would the second floor floor slab be there at all, and it's still present to the right or the south of the vertical column on the second floor. Just take a look at the photograph. Not only that, but even if a plane hit there, that column would have to be, because the plane allegedly, by the official story, came in at an oblique angle, that column would not be still vertical, even if it were still in place. The official story would not
be vertical. Barbara, I think you've made your point. We're running way over time here, so I'm going to give Wayne about a minute or two to respond, and then we're going to have to cut this off, okay? Thank you very much. Wayne, go ahead.
Yeah, so thanks, Barbara, for your comments. I think you misheard what I had said. I said that the wing is what impacted under the second floor slab in the vicinity of column 12. You're absolutely correct that the plane is high enough so that the top of the fuselage is going to be impacting the second floor, but there's not a lot of structure there as you know, as you know, when you go into a plane, you're standing on all the floors. If you look at the cross section, you'll see that all the strength is below, and there's a limited amount of structure above, certainly enough to keep the shape of the plane under a lot of forces. If you go take a look at the slide 58, in which I've superimposed the plane on the facade, it's a really difficult image to try to construct the, because the plane, if you were to have it impact at 38 degrees, the projection of the plane would be 157 feet, as I've mentioned in my notes. But because of the rotation that I've shown on the earlier slides, in the 30 series, you can see that the plane is rotating, and so it's not a continuous impact. There is this rotation, and the tail is what gets pushed off to the left as a result of the rotation caused by the right engine hitting the generator trailer. You have mentioned the column on the second floor, column 14, still being in place. Based on how the wall was built, it is my contention, and I've said this before, when you go to the presentation called how the exterior wall, how it was built, what you'll see is the facade around there, I believe, was impacted and fell away as a piece, as the two window slabs and their supporting seal structures separated from the bolts that were holding it in from above. So the plane is got the right altitude in figure 58, as near as I can tell. It is the bulk is below the second floor slab, as the ASCE has actually said. The impact is about the floor slab, but that is the nose cone area is, of course, and above is where people sit, and there's not a lot of structure.
I'm sorry, you just made a false statement. The ASCE report, the Pentagon Performance Report, does not say that the plane is all below the second floor slab. Absolutely not. It says
he didn't say that, Barbara. He didn't say that.
Above the ground.
No. Come on, Barbara. He didn't say that. He said he agrees that part of the fuselage hit above. He's just saying there's not enough mass with it to do damage. That's all. Okay.
No,
that's the difference.
I didn't say that. I'm sorry. That's not what he just said. He just said that the ASCE report
Wayne, is that what you said or not?
What I said was the plane impacted at about the second floor slab, but there's not, as Ken said, there's not much mass above it. And the ASCE report, you know, they gave a good estimate. Maybe they didn't look at it perfectly. We're talking, I think, the difference that we're arguing about is, 12 inches either direction. So I think
much more than that, Wayne. Anyway, your argument that there isn't very much mass in the upper half of the plane doesn't wash with the vertical column 14 on the second floor still being in place. It simply doesn't wash.
Yeah, well, I believe, like I said, that the entire wall was largely in place and fell away as the plane had passed. We have no visual photographic evidence of what that area looked like. And it's unclear whether, but it seems from the way that the thing that wall section is broken away, that it broke away as a slab. And if you take a look at the construction in the presentation that I did, that showed that there was no reinforced concrete in the walls. They were all 4-inch tubes supporting the blast-resistant walls. If you go take a look at that and you see how they were connected up above, you can see why that whole two window section could have just fallen away.
Column 14. You're exerting.
Yeah, we're going to have to leave it there. I know that there are differences of opinion, that very striking ones. We've had debates already between Barbara and Wayne, between Craig and Wayne, and we may need another one. Who knows? But in any case, there are differences of opinion here that we cannot settle tonight. We don't have the time. We're already way over time. So I would like to thank everyone who participated in this discussion, as well as Wayne for presenting, and move on to our announcements for this evening. Who has an announcement to share for this evening? Let me first make sure we're unmuted here.
So,
Yeah, thank you. Okay, so who has an announcement to share this evening? Anyone? An announcement for
This is Wayne.
Go ahead, Wayne.
Yes. So it appears, this is a standby. It looks like about the November, I think it's the 12th or the 18th, Bill Binney is going to be in New York City talking about some of the NSA systems that were put in place before 9/11 that were turned off, and then after 9/11 they were turned back on. Him and Ray McGovern talked about this where Barbara and a bunch of other people were in New York, but there's going to be another event similar to that early November. That's all. Thanks, over.
Thank you for that. When you get the details on that, would you please supply them? Thank you. Okay. Who else has an announcement?
Real quick, Barb?
Barb, go ahead.
Yeah, just reminding everybody that tomorrow, if it happens, is the deadline by federal statute for the declassification and release, unless Trump stops it and blocks it, of all of the remaining JFK assassination documents at the National Archives.
Hear, hear. Okay. Anybody else have an announcement?
Yeah, it's Craig.
Relative to that, everybody, if there are released records, you can imagine that the JFK assassination researchers will be going over them with a fine-tooth comb. And so if any are released that are of significance, we'll know it very quickly by the mainstream media, because like the New York Times, Washington Post, MSNBC, you know, CBS, ABC, we'll be going over them with a fine-tooth comb and reporting. But if any of them of significance are released, I just want everybody to know that there are, again this year, two major JFK assassination conferences, which could be very historic ones, in Dallas in mid-November. If anybody would like the details of those, I can send that.
Okay. Thank you, Barb. And Craig, you had an announcement.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, I'm going to make a statement about the Pentagon issue in the November call. Not so much a technical, another technical presentation, but more just a statement about where I think we stand with the issue and what I think, where I think the movement needs to go with it. And I really hope, I know there are a lot of people who probably have opinions about the issue, who probably don't voice them for one reason or another, and I hope that people have some comments or questions or statements or whatever so that it can be more of a discussion than just a statement or just a presentation. I'd love to hear from as many people as possible, just look forward.
Okay, then we're all forewarned, and please be ready to participate in a discussion that Craig is inviting on this subject next month. And by the way, that is the only agenda item we have listed for next month. So if you have an agenda item or you know of one that we should be pursuing, please write us and let us know. You have our email address.
This is Wayne. I've got one more thing to raise.
Another announcement?
Yes. I want to announce that based on the very interesting presentation Craig gave us at the last teleconference related to Google search engines,
yes,
I've located a couple of interesting articles on the World Socialist website that have actually made on themselves into the New York Times talking about this. I'm going to be posting one of them up on our 9/11 TAP website in a day or so, but it's I'm very intrigued by this whole concept of this is the next wave of censorship, and I want to thank Craig for doing this and think that should be a topic next call. Over.
Well, if you want to, would you like us to list you to discuss it further on the next call, Wayne?
Well, yeah, I suppose you can put me down.
Okay. We'll put you down. You can let me know the details as we go along, because right now we've got a fairly open agenda, so that's fine. And when you make that post to your own website, would you also send it to the Telecast listserv for the link?
Okay, very good.
Thank you. And again, anybody who's not on our teleconference listserv that would like to be, just email me and we'll get you right on. You can participate in the interim discussions that we have between teleconferences. And I think that does it for tonight, unless anybody has another quick announcement. Hearing none, then we'll close for this evening. Thank you all, and we'll see you the last Wednesday in November.
Okay.
So,
bye, everyone.
Good night. Thank you. Good night.